Welcome to the Lights Out Podcast. This is Chris Lights Out Lytle, and this is our journey to document the history of mixed martial arts. I've brought with me my friend, the MMA detective Mike Davis, and together we will preserve the history and hear some great stories from the world in the era of the no holds barred. Thank you and enjoy.
Welcome back to the Lights Out MMA History Podcast. I am Joey Venti. With me, as always, is the MMA detective, Mike Davis. Today, we have a very special guest, a veteran of over 20 fights in the UFC. Drew Dober's UFC longevity is incredible, but this interview will focus on his road to the UFC. Because of that, we have a man with us who was instrumental in Drew's rise to the regional scene. From Victory Fighting Championships, we have Victory J himself. Drew and Jay, thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me. And I can't believe Jay's on here.
I know, man. It's been a minute. It's been a little while, man. How have you been?
Good, good. Just doing the same old for the last, 15 years?
It's been a while. It's been a while. You look great, man.
Well, thanks. Thanks. I mean, getting punched in the mouth is apparently the fountain of youth. So.
So why don't we start from the beginning? So Drew, you were one of those people that a lot of people had heard about, and then Victory Fighting Championships kind of, they really made you step on a gas pedal. The guy did you no favors in regards to matchmaking when you kind of go through your record. And that was kind of the Victory thing. I mean, Jay, I mean, at Victory, how would you say your matchmaking style was?
We used to have a saying. And so I would travel all around the Midwest and see guys. And I had to see somebody fight before they could fight for us. I'd go and watch them fight. And Big Papa Schnocky would come along with me, and we'd watch fights. And then we'd break the fight down and say, like, if I, as a matchmaker, who do I want to see fight? That's really what it came down to. It was like, you know, how about this guy? How about this guy? And the saying we had is that you'll never get an easy fight, but you'll always get a fair one. And I always like to be straight with guys and say, hey, you know, this is where it's at, man. You know, and these guys came to produce, and it's that formula seemed to work.
Drew, how do you find your way into the mixed martial arts world?
Man, I can't run, jump, or catch a ball. So I had to learn pretty much how to fight people. But no, I joined martial arts, fell in love, and I was halfway decent at it, you know, give or take, like what we wanted to do. And then I saw my very first UFC fight with Frank Shamrock versus Jeremy Horn. And since I saw that fight, I fell in love. Like, it was like a physical chess match. And it wasn't like an emotional brawling. It was like, you know, the best martial arts you could possibly see that actually is functional. And I was like, I just want to do that. So I was bouncing between Muay Thai and mixed martial arts until, you know, I was acquainted to Victory J, and the rest is history.
So Jay, I mean, you just started with, you had to see somebody fight a few times before you put him on your card. How do you find Drew Dober?
So Victor, do you remember that?
I do actually. There was at the time with VFC, it was pro only. We didn't have any amateurs. And there was so much buzz about this young kid across the river that was fighting an event called Omaha Fight Club. And Omaha Fight Club was all amateur, and it was literally, it was an open forum. You show up with your gym bag, and you know, the guys come within 10 pounds of each other, and you get in and scrap.
Okay, so that is code word for no weigh-ins, somebody's backyard. If you're looking for insurance, you better go somewhere else. Drew,
that's
is
close.
am I right on that?
That's pretty close. So I kept hearing about this kid. And so I would go there on a Friday night, and there would be 30 fights. I mean, it'd be whoever wanted to fight, some 2-3 times a night sort of stuff. And, you know, Drew was just a spectacle, man. I mean, I couldn't believe, one, that, you know, for the physical shape that he was in, you didn't see that in the amateurs. And then, two, his skill level was just amazing. And I remember the first time I went, he was reffing that night as well as fighting. And it was just apparent. It was like, okay, we got to figure it out. So I think that he may have been one of the very first amateur undercards we had leading, and it just kind of took off from there, man. I mean, he had just as lot of a crowd reaction as any of the pros did, so it was amazing.
So, Drew, how would you describe the independent grind prior to VFC?
It's staying active and staying like often. You know, for me, it was like my amateur career was, let's see how many times we can fight in a possible year. And I think, you know, I was able to get 20 plus fights within a 2-year time frame, which nowadays, you know, everyone needs this fight camp, 8 weeks preparation. And man, the way we grew up, it was, you just show up and fought. Like, I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot of preparation. You didn't know who you were going to fight. You didn't know when you were going to fight. You just showed up and got it done. And I mean, that was just the beautiful thing about being raised in Nebraska. It's just, you know, we learned to adapt and overcome. We didn't have like, you know, so much thought behind fighting. You just went in there and did it. And man, I just got to say, like, I grew up watching like the Victory Fighting Championships, and that was kind of like where I wanted to go. And so in these unsanctioned bar fights, I mean, I was 17 years old fighting like grown adults. And man, I just remember one fight in particular, I ran into Victory J, and I was so like shell-shocked. I was like, oh man, like this is the promoter that I want to fight for. And I don't know if he remembers, but I walked up to him and I was like, hey, I'm fighting tonight. Make sure you watch because I'm going to be fighting on your undercard soon.
That's pretty cool. So you, what I can track back, Mick Doyle had a gym at Mid America Martial Arts, Mama, you guys used to call it. Is that where you started?
Yes. Aaron Cerrone at Mid America Martial Arts. So we were considered the Mama's boys. I grew up training with like the Ellenbergers, Ryan Jensen, Jason Brills. I mean, the list goes on and on about, you know, the names that I was, you know, getting beat up by in the gym every single day.
So just so everybody can kind of wrap their heads around it, usually people, a coach, it would be a dream come true if they got one person from their first fight all the way to the UFC. You just named about four people right there, including yourself, that all made it to the big show.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I think it's just Omaha, Nebraska. You know, majority of them came from kind of where I was from, but you know, there's multiple other gyms like Premier, McDoyle's. Is like there's something in the water in Omaha, Nebraska. All starting from was a Steve Jenham in UFC 3, Jeremy Horn fighting Chuck Liddell. I mean, the list goes
Matt
on
Anderson.
And on. And
yeah,
on.
Matt Anderson, Jeremy Horn's brother.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the list goes on. And so I always tell people, like, if you're from Omaha, Nebraska, you either play football or you learn to fight people. And, man, even now we have the number one pound-for-pound boxer, you know, defending his title here soon. So, man, Omaha, Nebraska is such an honor to, you know, come from such an amazing place.
Were you a street fighter growing up?
No, I was actually anti-confrontational. I was a nerd. Man, I just like getting physical. Right. And it, man, it translates to, you know, who I am today. There is zero emotion with my fighting. Like I'm just trying to like trade concussions and have fun doing it. And when I was a young kid, man, if I hated you, we didn't talk. If I liked you, we're probably gonna try to fight each other.
That's fucking wild. Victory J, September 7, 2007, VFC 20 aces. You never had an amateur fight until you ran into this guy and you adjusted with that on this card. I think this is the first time ever. Dan Lancer was the opponent. Victory J, what was your thought process of matching him up on this first fight for you?
I think, again, it was a little difficult because some of these guys also had pretty stacked records. And I believe that Lancer was from the Panhandle and they train hard out there. They didn't have big gyms, but they made up for it in just toughness. And I mean, these, again, everybody in the area fighting on a weekly basis was a fairly regular thing. You'd fight Friday night in one town, you know, sometimes you would fight the very next day in another town. And so, you know, these guys were constantly fighting and, you know, it was trying to find a good matchup. And, you know, Dan was a military guy. He was older.
He
fought in North Platte, Nebraska quite a bit and came from a pretty decent camp of guys. He was out training with guys. I believe he was with Kelly Wiseman, who was with the Militech camp for quite some time. And so he's very reputable. And man, it was definitely a tough first fight to put against it. I mean, it's a tough fight for anybody, yeah. But for the first fight, Let's see what happens.
Yeah, Drew, going into that, what were your thoughts? Was it kind of same old thing, or were you just kind of settling into this lifestyle?
Man, I barely even had a thought about Dan Lancer. I was finally fighting in the Victory Fighting Championship, which is something that, like, I dreamed about. So I was like, man, he's got two arms, two legs. He's probably going to try to kill me. But, man, I get to do the one thing that I've been questing to do on a local stage, which is to fight for the VFC. And, man, I was all gung-ho, like 18 years old, couldn't be any happier, getting to do the thing that I love in front of, like, a larger audience. And, yeah, I knew Dan was a tough guy, a solid wrestler. But, I mean, I'm pretty sure I said in the interview before the fight with him, he's going to try to punch me until that doesn't work. And then he's going to try to take me down. So all opponents are very similar, but now I get to fight for the VFC.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Dan was a high-end wrestler, high-end high school wrestler. You knock him out. It was kind of one of those wrestler versus striker things. And you roll into VFC 21, you knock out Jesse Wolf. And then right around this time, I think your manager, Ryan Stoddard, and Victory J did an all call for amateurs all over the country because they believed they had the number one prospect, amateur prospect in the entire country. Do you remember, Drew, who they tried to set you up with?
I mean, numerous people. I mean, there was like talks of me fighting Iaquanta, fighting Dustin Poirier. I mean, when we put that call out to try to fight the best amateur in the country, I mean, I still recognize the names that came across. I get a lot of like heat or from that time of like, you know, why didn't you just turn pro? But people forget that I was also competing in Muay Thai. And when you turn professional in MMA, you got to turn professional in Muay Thai. And I wasn't ready to turn professional in Muay Thai yet, but I still wanted to keep staying active. So like we had to stay amateur for a longer period of time. And then with that being said, we had to find the opponents that were going to, you know, really rip my head off.
Victory J, what was the idea in regards to this?
So finding an opponent for Drew was becoming progressively more difficult. Guys saw him, they're like, oh. And so we kind of came up with the idea. At the time, I was a columnist for Grappling Magazine, and so I had the forum, and I was traveling all over, and I was seeing all these guys, and guys kept asking, you know, what's it going to take to get a shot? And so it was the open call. I used the magazine as the forum. We put it out on all the internet, you know, and basically it came down to, we'll take any names in North America. Doesn't matter if it's Canada, doesn't matter if it's Mexico, we'll fly you in and see what happens. And Al was the top prospect. We had that lined up for quite some time.
Henzo's top guy. Yeah.
And, you know, but he ended up going pro right before that fight. So we had it booked. He got the opportunity to be on a big card up there. So we went back and looked at who we had. And I believe we settled on Adam Cunningham out of Indiana. I believe he was just a stud wrestler out of Indiana. It was one of Chaz Bowling's guys. And, you know, it was a really cool little experiment, and it worked. And, you know, at the time, nobody was really doing anything like that. And hats off for Drew to really say, hey, whoever you put in front of me. I know a lot of guys will say that, you know, I'll fight whoever they put in front of me. But, you know, he literally did, man. I mean, he backed up his words and did it and made it look like, I mean, made it look easy. I mean, it made it on our highlight reel. It was great.
Drew, I'm going to be very direct with you in regards to this, and I would never say this if it were true, but prior to this interview, Victor J and I were talking, and I remember seeing you locally. You get weigh-ins and stuff like that. You know, I'm from the Chicagoland area, but I traveled all over the Midwest, and I would always go, oh, that guy's juiced. He's juiced. Like, looks good, fights his ass off, not afraid, but like, when he gets off that stack, I'm going to be interested to see like what kind of go he has. And USADA comes along and not a single thing changes. I think you've got like special genetics.
I mean, it could be just special genetics, work hard while being malnourished. I mean, I'm quite blessed. I mean, I got the square jaw. It looks pretty, but it's also very actable in a cage as well. So I'm just built for the sport. And that just really comes down to it. It's, you know, I was put on this earth to do one thing, and that is to be a modern gladiator. So I'm built, I look the part, and we're able to perform similarly.
All right. So VFC 23, Tri-State Champion, which was the rival to the Omaha Fight Club. It was always an argument of what minor league backyard organization. It's kind of like the Juggalos fighting with each other. You had Wes Clark in that fight. Wes was always, I remember him, I've seen him fight live a couple of times, a little bit off. Do you remember fighting Wes Clark?
I mean, I can't forget fighting Wes Clark. So the thing is, like, I fought him twice. And, like, this guy is, like, outrageous. One, did you know we share the same birthday? Like, we were born in the same exact day, right? And we were each other's very first fight. He was my very first amateur fight, like, in my entire career. And then, like, a year and a half, possibly 2 years later, I'm not quite sure, like, I come in with our rematch, 7-0, and he was, like, 42-1. Like, the dude fought every weekend, multiple times. And he was just a spectacle as well, man. He was putting people to sleep. The fans really loved him, like the way he acted. And so, man, that rematch in the VFC was so much fun.
All right. So that was, I'm glad you kind of cleared something up. So if you look at his Sure Dog picture, it's got a timestamp on it. And if you look at the timestamp and compare it to his record, he's only 1-1 at that point. But if you're saying he's like a 50 Fight Club member almost, but he's also got an NWA pro wrestling belt with him. Victory J, do you think he like just took the picture with that, or do you think he may have won it on one of the independent grind shows?
I'm going to guess is that at the time as well, there wasn't too many championship belt manufacturers. So I'm going to guess that he probably got it on, you know, an event that maybe wasn't as well established. But the thing that was great about guys like Wes is that he would wear those belts to other events. He would show up in the arena with his belts on, and everybody be like, who's this kid, you know, and really kind of start a buzz about him with all his championship belts and stuff. It was a really cool time.
Yeah, he was loud. You know, he made sure you knew that he was there. Yeah, he was, yeah, interesting guy. Drew, when you got called to Strike Force against Lumumba Sayers on the undercard, did you get a taste of what it was like to be on the big show?
Dude, that was one of the most memorable moments of my life. Was like, one, walking into the gym and having my coach, Aaron Cerrone, pretty much tell me, like, hey, do you want to fight in Strike Force in 2 weeks up a weight class? And I was like, jumped to the idea. I was like, yeah, absolutely, let's do it. Of course, showing up to the Broomfield Event Center come fight day in Colorado, and the dude is twice my size. Like, he didn't make 170. He's nowhere near 170. Come fight day, he was about 200 plus pounds. But walking out in the Broomfield Event Center was the first time I saw my name up on the lights on that banner. The first time you take your shirt off and you're not cold because of the spotlights before you step into that canvas. And that was like the first time I was like in that professional big show. And all the anxiety followed. I remember I was so tranced before that fight, man. I'm like thinking, looking around, looking in the arena, looking at where I was at. And then I heard of the announcer say, like, standing 6 foot tall. And I'm like, I'm not 6 foot. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot. That's my opponent. You're announcing my opponent right now. But I was like, I was so lost in where I was at and what I was doing that I couldn't even pay attention to, like, I was actually in a fight.
That's wild. Well, it's one of those scary knockouts when you land face first. And we're talking about a guy that fought a who's who, including win over Scott Smith, who's a legend in my opinion. And I mean, you cleaned house in about 16 seconds.
Right. Well, I mean, in the combination of this fight and, of course, the fight prior, which is the number one amateur in the country, we found out that I had an answer to the problems, and that was my left hand. If I can make a connection with my left hand, I'm halfway decent at putting your lights out.
Yeah, absolutely. Legit. You go on, you beat Adam Cunningham. You had mentioned it earlier, who is an NCAA MAC champion. You rear naked choke him. So You're a striker, but wrestling is not giving you any problems yet. And then you run into a bad blood match with Jimmy Sepiel, who is being referred to as a ground wizard and a prodigy. Yeah, this was like one of the most heated matches that I remember, like, coming across the Midwest region. Your take, Drew.
Oh yeah, yeah, Jimmy Seiple, man, what a character that guy was. And when you started fighting in the OFC, which is like the bar that people tend to fight in, I was getting text messages in like comments of like some guy calling out my name after his fight, which was, I thought it was outrageous. Like, we're all just fighting in a bar, you know, it's not that important. But he kept calling out my name. I want to fight Drew Dober. I want to fight Drew Dober. So finally, I had to see him for myself. So I showed up to one of the events and he was fighting that night. And man, I just remember the moment, like he was like getting ready to fight and he looks at me and he like waves at me and I'm sitting ringside. They start fighting. He pushes that guy up against the fence, looks over his shoulder and like gives me a wink and then throws the guy to the ground and ends up submitting him. I'm like, not only is he fairly decent in fighting, but like that charisma that he carried too. And of course, after he gets his hand raised, called me out once again. So I just knew that it was just a matter of time before we fought each other.
Who are you doing jiu-jitsu with at this point?
I was working with Ed Schaub and Anthony Carlson, which is a tutorage under Rodrigo Vaggi in St. Louis.
Vaggi's got his fingerprints everywhere.
I know, right?
Yeah, Mike Rogers, that whole St. Louis, Missouri scene. Yeah, mm-hmm. Vaggi was something special. Well, you turned pro. What was the – you had mentioned that you had some issues before you turned pro. Regards to Muay Thai, at this point, whatever issues you had, you kind of jumped that hurdle. What mentally made you understand that you were ready?
I think it was just we put a series of Aaron Cerrone from Mid-America Martial Arts. His goal for me as an amateur was he wanted me to lose. He wanted me to get beat up. He wanted somebody to just, rip me apart, and we got to learn how to recover as an amateur. But it just didn't come. We stepped out there, fought at 170, fought at 145, fought at 155, fought undefeated guys, and we were coming back with the win. So it was more so the challenge that intrigued me, right? I don't really care about the round times, the getting paid. It was more so like I was just ready for a bigger and better challenge. And so we decided to turn pro, and then Victory J and I had such a hard time finding opponents.
All right, Drew, when I do my research, I call everybody and I'm like, okay, fuck it, dude. We're going to get, and I'm not saying I gotcha. We're not doing any of that, but I always kind of like to know the foundation of which the house is built on to kind of work the interview. There is absolutely nothing in your background. Zero. How do you maintain such a clean image?
I just live how I want to live. I don't know if I'm going to answer this question. I think it was like when I was very young, like when I was like 5 years old, watching Bloodsport, Jean-Claude Van Damme, you're like a little kid and you just imagine like these superheroes and these heroes and what they should be. And so I just had it in my head that I just wanted to be a superhero. And, like you got to make those tough decisions on how to like carry yourself with integrity and honor and respect. And I made a decision at like at such an early age that like, no matter how hard it's going to get, this is how I'm going to live my life. And now I'm in a beautiful position where I'm on the highest stage in the world. And I had every chance to be an asshole. But I decided to live with integrity and respect. And I love showcasing that in one of the biggest stages in the world.
It's real easy to say something like that. It's another thing to do it day after day after day. And that's not easy. Like even some of the most disciplined of athletes have a bad day. Any bad day you've had, it hasn't made the news.
Well, I appreciate it, man. Like I always tell people, like everyone wants to try to be a gangster, want to be hard, they want to be a boss. But I think the hardest thing to do is live with respect to other people. It's the hardest thing to do. Acknowledgement of another person, like it takes a lot out of you. So, man, if you want to be a badass, respect other people.
Let's talk about the Ellenberger brothers. What was your introduction to them? When did you know that they were special?
I mean, I have scars from Jake Ellenberger. Was my introduction. No, he was fighting, if I remember correctly, I can't remember the opponent's name, but he was fighting for the welterweight title in the VFC. And so he's getting ready to fight a wrestler. And and so I was pretty much the guinea pig, the fodder for him to use to train for this fight. And lo and behold, I was supposed to be a wrestler for him, and he was practicing knees. So he gave me a good Harry Potter right down the center from one of those killer knees that he was practicing. And but watching that fight live, I saw for the first time that people are able to bring what they train in the gym to the fight. And man, he tore this guy up. It was probably one of the bloodiest BFC fights, title fights that I've ever seen. But he did it with knees, and his opponent and I have something in common, and that's the scars from Jake Ellenberger.
Victor J, do you recall that?
I do. I do. I believe that was the Mark Bear fight.
Yes.
Mark Bear is was a Meskwaki, Native American, super tough. Him and Near went toe-to-toe for quite a rivalry as well. And Drew's absolutely right. That is the bloodiest fight we had. It's the bloodiest fight I've seen to date. You could smell the iron from all the blood that was on the mat. The guys were just slipping in it. I mean, it was absolutely crazy. It ended up coming down to a doctor stoppage, not due to the loss of the blood, but due to the safety of the fighters because of all the blood. And it was just a vinyl canvas. It wasn't, you know, a canvas canvas. It was vinyl. So there's sliding around. It was absolutely nuts. And I know Mark was super pissed that the fight got stopped, but it was the right call. And, you know, after seeing so many fights, you become pretty jaded to blood.
A little numb to it.
That does it. Yeah, that did it. You know, the desensitized just went right out the window when you can smell it and you see it. It's just all over the place. But it made for one hell of a main event.
Yeah, the Ellenberger brothers, you know, you're talking about, you know, Jake never wrestled in high school and he's a college wrestling coach. I mean, it's just in a good, like a respected one. It's not just, man, we got to fill the spot, grab the janitor. They actually sought him out. Your pro debut, Frank Caraballo.
Was it Frank
Caraballo?
Yes.
You had not left the first round up until this time. So, like, one of the big questions, like, I remember, like, talking Drew Dober, it's, all right, he's going to meet a good nail. Like, he's got some hammers, but when he meets that nail, can he go three rounds? That's a huge, like, hurdle for a lot of guys. You finally hit the second round with Frank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was we had such a hard time finding an opponent. I think he was kind of like the fifth opponent that we were scheduled to fight. And we went through four others. And, you know, due to various reasons, they weren't able to make it happen. We got him. And, you know, I think you can ask Victor J, but it wasn't an ideal matchup because he's already had three fights in Bellator and I was making my professional debut. So he was definitely a higher jump than we wanted, but I mean, we wanted a challenge. And
Drew, he was also the NAAFS, which is a very, at this time, a very respected organization out of Ohio. And he's out of, I think it was a Fearless Fight Team, which was kind of the counterpart to Strong Style. Those are two early MMA gyms that were very high end in the Midwest. Like, this is no friggin' joke, man.
Right. And so, I mean, that was the challenge and we loved it. And we put together the plan and man, he was a strong striker. So we came in to wrestle and we got in and like, I think I still have, you know, a scar on my head from that fight where he hit me with a great elbow and I was just bleeding all over the VFC's canvas. But yeah, we rose the occasion and then out wrestled him, TKO'd him in the second, and we got it done.
Yeah. Victory J, did you have any influence on the Fighter Magazine contest to train with Extreme Couture? Because in 2009 of August, this gentleman was the person that was chosen.
You know, I had a lot of behind the scenes talks with just a ton of people. Like, I would get a call when somebody would ask about it. It could be anybody from, you know, coaches, guys trying to set up to, you know, Sean Shelby. We text all the time. He would just say, he'd be like, hey, what do you know about this guy? And we just sit there and just talk shop about the fighters. So, you know, even if it wasn't something that I had a direct, you know, like, business attachment with or anything like that, I just love to talk shop. So I'd sit on the phone for, you know, an hour with somebody just talking about, you know, a potential prospect or, you know, matchups or just whatever. So, you know, it could have happened. You know, I don't recall directly, but we had conversations like that all the time.
Drew, what was your experience? Well, first of all, how did you win the contest?
I mean, we just put our video in and, man, people seem to pay attention. I just threw it up on social media that I was doing it. We got the most votes and, luckily enough. And I also think it was because like I was out of all the contestants, I was probably the most ideal one. So, I mean, they might've fudged some numbers, but, yeah, we got the most votes and had the opportunity to train at Extreme Couture.
Can you tell us what that experience was like? Because you're a 1-0 pro. You know, you had a successful amateur career, and now you're training with literally guys fighting in the UFC.
Yeah, man, it was surreal. I got to, you know, train with the idols, be surrounded by the idols. I had Vitor Belfort watching me spar. Like, it was just, like, outrageous. Like, it was just more than I could ever imagine. And but the thing that I took away from it was I can hang. Like between the training sessions and the sparring sessions and everything else, like I can hang with these guys. And it was just a confidence boost that I was ready for the UFC at an earlier age. And it was just a matter of time.
What was your experience like with Sean Tompkins?
It was great. The Canadian crew. So Mark Hominick, Sam Stout, I mean, they really guided me, you know, taught me kind of what it was like to train in such a large gym. They gave me the new routines. At this point, I've only been training at the same gym, doing the same things over and over. So they were like showing me other things that we can do. And, you know, I think they were really trying to recruit me to come to Extreme Couture. Man, I really enjoyed that experience. Yeah, I just had a love for where I came from, which is Omaha, Nebraska. So I just wasn't ready to move yet. But man, I like that. It was such an eye-opening experience, being there.
What about Juni Browning? He was at the gym at that point.
Man, what a hard-nosed dude. I mean, it was just, you got all these characters, just a bunch of characters. I mean, we live in MMA, which is just a bunch of psychos in the Wild West, just, you know, fighting for a living. And man, I was more like, I was really intrigued on just learning where these people came from, how they got there. And yeah, I just, Juni Browning on top of a war machine was there. And we all know what he got himself into. Man, it was a unique group for sure. And a good reference for me to make sure I stay on the right path.
I'll tell you what, man, that is a very powerful statement that you said. Sean Tompkins, obviously no longer with us. I have so much respect for him. I always try to go out of my way to give that guy the props that he deserves. But he was also burning the candle at both ends. Mm-hmm. And some of the names that just got brought up may not have been real good influences for, you know, and vice versa for each other.
Right. Which, I mean, like, I'm quite blessed into being surrounded by the people that I was with in Omaha, Nebraska. So when I was in Extreme Couture in like the shock and awe gym of the who's of who of MMA, like, I wasn't distracted because, like, I did, again, I had a strong belief in who I wanted to be personally, and these guys didn't match it. And you have to surround yourself with like-minded individuals. And again, I wasn't ready to be a part of that yet.
What about Ray Sefo? Did you have any interaction with him? I think he was there at that time.
Right. And I still have a connection with Ray. I literally saw him a month ago. Man, it was just seeing his coaching. See his, he's brilliant. Like, he's able to watch pad rounds, watch sparring rounds, and come up with like these detailed constructive criticisms. And yeah, it's just like I said, like Ray Sifu, Vitor Belfort, Sean yeah. Tompkins, like, dude, like, man, there was such genius in that gym that, yeah, it was motivating.
Hominick, you know, the machine, is this work ethic? I've heard legendary things about his work ethic in the gym. What did you see when you were working out with him?
Yeah, the week that I was there, I think it was a week or 2 weeks. He was one of the most, he was actually the most diligent fighter in that room. I mean, he was the guy that had the bedtime. He was at the gym first. He left the gym at the latest, warm up, cool down. And when you trained, he didn't waste any word. Like, he was so focused. Like, he wasn't there for banter. He wasn't having conversations. He was there to get better. And like, I think Mark Hominick was the person that I try to align myself with for majority of the trip.
You know, with Hominick, if you look at like Hominick, Stout, Herdecky, they all have their own gym right now. Those are all local guys that met each other, all became top 10 in the world at one point, top five in certain instances. And they just found each other, and now they have their own gym in Ontario.
Right. I mean, you got to have what I call the accountability buddy. And so they were able to find another talented individual to be with. And so between him, like Mark Hominick, Sam Stout, Chris Horodesky, like those guys were like, they were together and they bounced not only technique, but also lifestyles off each other. And I think it's just really cool, like how far they were able to get, you know, as a team.
Yeah. Like a legit team. This isn't just poaching, you know, we got some big game hunting. No, they were a legit shit team. Victory J, Brad Gumm had a very interesting MMA career. Joe Daddy Stevenson, I think Chris Brennan, he's got wins over. What was his reputation as a coach at this point?
You know, if we're kind of dialing back the time here, he put out tough dudes. I mean, it's definitely you know, if you trained with him and you came out of his camp, you know, you were going to be somebody that was legit. And, you know, at the time too, there were so many garage gym guys that were out there, or maybe they came from like a jiu-jitsu academy and you didn't really know what their actual striking or MMA was going to be like. And with Brad's guys, they were all pretty well-rounded. And so I think if, you know, if a guy like Brad were to call up and say, "Hey, I got a guy," you know, he's definitely got my ear.
So future Tough 15 veteran, prison stare Chaz Hackett is your next opponent. Now you're just coming, I mean, tough guy. You're coming from one of the greatest experiences in terms of training in your life. And this is your first fight.
Yes, man. I love that guy. No, I suffered the very first loss of my career against Chase Hackett. Which the best way I could translate that to is I was fighting as a respected amateur and he came in as a focused professional. And it was a very different style of fighting that I've ever experienced. Like, I was just a talented individual. I got to go into a fight and do pretty much whatever I wanted. And I found a way to win always. And only against Chase Hackett that we got out wrestled. So he came in with a game plan for me and it was working fantastically. And then the next thing I knew, I was down two rounds and I had to get a finish in the third round. And I went out and I gave the biggest beating of his life in that third round. But unfortunately, we weren't able to get that finish. And we went to the judges' scorecards and I knew that we ran out of time and I suffered my first loss.
Now, I wasn't there, but I remember hearing through the grapevine, Victor J, it actually may have came out of your mouth. It was a war. And like, from the couch, the armchair, oftentimes when somebody goes from one camp to another camp and then back to the original camp, they can kind of get caught in the middle in regards to training rather than being all in on a certain aspect or component of the fight. Did you think that may have happened there? It came into play?
I feel like it's less to do about the gym bouncing and more to do about kind of how I was winning fights at the time. Again, like I was just being a talented amateur. I didn't have a reason to become hyper-focused on any particular opponent. I mean, my pro debut, we went through five, right? So like, I wasn't thinking about opponents. Like I said earlier, like if you have two hands, two legs, like we're just going to fight. Growing up in the Omaha Fight Club, we didn't know who our opponents were. We don't think about that stuff. We just show up and get the job done. And unfortunately, that was the reason I lost, because Chase Prisonstare Hackett had the southpaw friend of Chris Camozzi. You know, they came up with such a great game plan at Factory X, and they knew the things he needed to do to beat me as an individual. And that's when he came into the fight with, and I couldn't keep up with that diligent game plan.
Brad Gumm living off the grid right now. I was told somebody spotted him 3 months ago. I've been trying to track him down for an interview for about 2 years. And he said he looks like a Unabomber, you know, and he you know, has the same type of dialogue as well with him. Victory J, what do you attribute? Drew's a nice guy, easy guy. Why was he so hard to match? I mean, Midwest is like flush with talent.
He's good. I mean, that's it. People would see, you know, and look at his opponents, the guys he's beaten. And it's hard. It's also that particular timeline in his career. A lot of guys were going pro, and at that point, they were being extremely selective about their matchups. You know, they weren't taking – I don't want to say they weren't taking the toughest fights, but anytime that you fight a guy like Drew, there's a very good chance you're going to lose. So a lot of times guys would, you know, not be ready, or it would be in a case where a guy pulls out, a guy decides to, you know, maybe take a higher caliber fight, because at this particular point, the big shows now are poaching these guys, which is the entire purpose of our show, was to provide a stage for the larger events to come in and say, okay, I want this kid. And it was happening, and it was happening. We would match up guys, and I mean, all down the line, a week before the fight, they'd get a call to the UFC. And so now we got to quickly find somebody. And when you're fighting guys at that level that Drew is, it happened. You know, the guys are going to be last minute additions to, you know, a larger card, a televised card, a pay-per-view card. And it makes it extremely difficult, but it makes it a lot easier when you got a guy who's going to fight anybody.
All right. So that's incredible. Like, if the UFC's poaching your opponents, Drew, was there any communication with you? Say, you know what? You don't have enough fights. You're just willing to fight guys with a ton of fights. Oh, you're in a tricky position at this point in your career.
Yeah, we're always trying to fight up, but you know, I was just a high risk, low reward type of person, right? People are gonna have to take a chance on me, right? And when you come in with a left hand and a chin, you know you're gonna go to war every single time. And you know, not a lot of people were willing to engage in such a high risk for, you know, just another notch on the record.
Joe Doherty's on a card. He was 9-3. He had like about a 90% finish rate. I loved watching that guy fight regionally. Do you remember him, Drew?
I mean, I trained with the dude. Like, he trained as fantastic as he fought, man. What a dirty, gringy type of fighter, man. I loved it every moment he fought.
Victor J, he was a regular on your cards as well.
Yes. Yeah. Joe's great. I actually work with him still to this day. He's a referee for the Nebraska Athletic Commission. One of the best we have. He does the BKFCs whenever they come into town. He's just a stand-up guy, and having that experience as a professional fighter is absolutely priceless when you become an official.
Yeah. Are you in Colorado now, Drew?
I am. I moved out here, I think, 10, going on 11 years now.
How do you like the change in environment?
I mean, luckily enough, I found a place that wasn't an extreme change in environment. I mean, we made the decision to move out of Nebraska. I was like, feel like the last professional fighter to get out. We were looking at Florida, California, New York, and it was just, it's just such an extreme move to where Colorado, one of the best MMA spots in the country, but also a very Midwest spot for me. So yeah. I got to kind of not move too far away from home.
I will even say that in terms of like MMA meccas, Florida's got some high-end gyms, very spread out. Albuquerque's got one gym. There's nothing like Colorado. You guys have got several high-end gyms, all within driving distances of each other, and all of them expanding.
Right, right. It's just a melting pot. I still tell people, you know, staff members of the UFC, they're like, so why Denver? And, you know, I tell them, I was like, hey, we have world champions, top 10 fighters in every single gym, high altitude, the Olympic Training Center. I mean, we have like the Nuggets, the Avalanche, the Broncos. Like, this place is for athletics. And man, it was probably one of the best decisions that I've made in my mixed martial arts career.
I've never seen that many high-end gyms in one city. It's one thing like here. Florida's a big state, fantastic gyms there, but they're hours apart in certain instances. To where in Denver, you got seven, like that. What was it? Elevation is about the size of like a Walmart right now. It's huge.
Huge. Yeah. If you're trying to get beat up, this is the place for it. I mean, I tell people all the time, Monday through Friday, I'm just getting my ass kicked. Right. Like, this is just monsters out here.
I will even say you got to be careful going to Colorado if you're on the way up, because you're going to wind up a B-side for somebody in the gym, and you've probably got UFC talent.
Right, right. Which, I mean, the reason I chose Team Elevation over, you know, Extreme Couture and all those other gyms was not only do we have the talent and the gyms out here, but we also have a camaraderie out here, to where I have a lot of faith in our JV freshman squad, because I mean, they're getting like as much notoriety, like respect and like technique as everyone else. Like, it's not like the Miletic Academy where you're up here and everyone else is just meat, right? Out here, it's, we're all trying to, you know, bring each other up, like coaching staff and fighters as well. So man, if you're going to come into the sport, I think Denver is probably the best place for you.
Another thing as well, there's no animosity between coaches. They tend to allow fighters to go from gym to gym, the little tweaks, hand pad holding. I've never seen a community of mixed martial arts like I have Denver.
Right, right. No one's trying to steal fighters from each other.
No.
We all just try to complement each other. And Team Elevation is probably one of the biggest advocates of that. Of just, we have so many coaches, so many fighters, and it's always about the fighters first. What does the fighter need? And it's such a fun thing to watch.
Your third professional fight, third professional fight, Brandon Gertz, a current teammate of yours as well. One of Justin Gaethje's buddies. You have got a very, very tough road in your first five professional fights.
Mm-hmm. You only live once. You might as well, get the challenges early. I think my biggest fault is I just did not know how to wrestle. And I think everyone that watches MMA knows that wrestling is the biggest martial art that you can bring into the cage. And I lacked wrestling. So I try to make it up everywhere else, and it didn't work for long fights. And so Brandon Gertz, even though I destroyed his body, he had the control time, so he won by decision.
Gertz, I think current BKFC roster fighter. I've seen him fight a couple times live. Bellator, good run at Bellator out of the Minnesota area. I've seen that guy fight a lot. Nick Nolte, you fight in Bellator, 16. He's out of K2L Grindhouse, Kill to Live Grindhouse. That was the kind of age when this was going on. Not an easy opponent. You get your rematch with Jimmy Sipo. Second round, ground and pound. And you pick up a roommate around this time, Seth Daniels.
Yep.
You guys couldn't be more opposite.
I know, right? But I think he just liked helping me out. I mean, I was just like, at that time, I was just a struggling fighter, like living in my car, doing odd jobs. And it's really hard to, like, we've seen all the Rocky movies. I mean, outside, scenarios kind of affect the way you perform. And I was trying to be the best fighter in the world living out of my car. And Seth, bless his heart, he rose above and just gave me the opportunity to kind of pursue my dreams.
Seth currently working for ADCC, doing a lot of the technical stuff for them. I'll see him in September. Cody Frank out of Kansas City. You worked out at Team Quest for this one.
The Team Quest one was earlier in my career. Okay. That one I was still sticking with Mid-America Martial Arts. I think, and also at that time, I was fighting so often that I really didn't have time to go train anywhere else. Between professional Muay Thai and MMA, I mean, I think we strung together 6 fights in 6 months. I was fighting every single month. So, we couldn't drive very far away from the gym because we had to be there all day, every day.
Did you stay with Matt Lindland at Team Quest? Where'd you stay at?
No, so I stayed in, it was such a rough little joint. I stayed in like a Days Inn across the street.
How was Chris the homeless Circo. People? And how was the homeless people between the gym and your hotel?
Yeah, I mean, one of them was Matt Horwich. No offense to Matt, but man, that was again, like that also just motivated me to make sure I stay in my lane because, man, those guys were just rough. Ed Herman, and like they would just literally take the chew out of their mouth, throw their mouthpieces in, beat the crap at each other, and they just called it a day. And I was like, oh, man, I got to do a little bit more technique than this. I can't just be sparring every day. But it was a fun experience. But, man, those guys were losing brain cells.
Were you there when Evan Tanner was there?
No, not Evan Tanner. Mine was around the was it the IFL day where they had like the gorilla team gorilla or something like that. Okay. So I was training with Ryan Schultz, Ian, I forgot, he was kind of like the owl. Ed Herman broke my nose, but put a timestamp on this one. I was 18 years old when I did this.
Really?
Yeah.
Was Robert Fowles there?
No, he was a guy. Where was he? I don't think he made it to Extreme Couture yet, but no, I did not see him there. Probably the most prestigious name that I could drop was Kale Sonnen.
So Kale was there, and at Robert Fowles. So everybody at home can kind of understand. He was a coach at the gym, managed a lot of the guys, never had a jiu-jitsu match, never wrestled, never had an MMA bout. And in a room full of Randy Couture, Kale Sonnen, Evan Tanner, Matt Lindland, Dan Henderson, they asked him to be a coach. Like, to get the respect of all, even Chris Lieben, all of them respected Fowles, having never done anything in terms of athletic accomplishments. So he obviously passed. I got a ton of respect for him. Cody Frank, you win in the second round by KO. Super duper Bobby Cooper, you finally find your cross that finish line on the winning end of a decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, at that, again, we just went back to our original ways of just finding fights and getting after it, learning from my losses of just fighting for a decision and focusing on an opponent and like game planning, right? We're not being chaos. Now we're being diligent on each and every single opponent, but again, the truth of just staying active, staying as busy as possible. You only live once.
Scott Morton, training partner of yours.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't go as far as training partner. I think he just like beat me up.
Another tough dude. Yeah, you guys had a rough room. Ryan Jensen. I mean, all of you guys had just legendary careers on the independent scene. And you know, a few of you, you know, peeped your head into the UFC. Dakota Cochran, another one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tough individuals. And like I said, Omaha, Nebraska was just producing fighters. And I mean, we were just all close knit together with nothing to do in Nebraska other than just beat the crap at each other and make each other better. And man, it was such a blessing to be able to, you know, coincidentally be raised in such a place.
You cornered Jensen when he fought Keith Wisniewski. I thought.
Yeah, I held his water bottle in his t-shirt. I wouldn't say I cornered him.
Okay. I remember seeing you there. Kurt Podney. Yeah. Do you remember Kurt Podney?
Yeah. You know, such a – my first Muay Thai coach. He taught me so much. And then, you know, once we had the gym split in Omaha, Nebraska, he cornered against me as well. But, yeah, Kurt Podney, what an amazing man that guy is.
Junior Hernandez, he's out of TSG Combat Sports. He's got 5-6 with wins over Eric Weissley, as well as a few other UFC veterans.
Yeah.
At this point, was the UFC, you had to have been on their radar.
Yeah, I think I was on their radar, but we didn't really have any strong communication just quite yet. We were still in the proving grounds. They wanted to make sure that I was able to hang. And, Junior Hernandez, what a fight that was.
Legendary guy within the Midwest. Victory, Jay, are we talking Miletic guy, correct?
Correct. I remember seeing Junior fight, and the first time he fought was at a ballpark. It was one of Monty Cox's events, an extreme challenge, and it was outdoors. And Pat was just saying, this is the kid you got to see. This was his protege. It was his top student. I believe Pat passed the gym on to him, and he became the head coach at Miletic after the fact. And he was just tough. He was cut from the same cloth as guys like Drew. I mean, that's all this dude did was fight. And he was in the gym, and when he wasn't in the gym, he was in the cage or in the ring. And so, you know, he was definitely, and again, you know, if he wanted to make a name in the Midwest, he got to go up against another name in the Midwest. And that's kind of how that came about.
Drew, your fight with Jordan Johnson, he was on a night fight win streak. He was out of Martial Arts Pride. A lot of people had you as the underdog going into this.
Yep. It was just because he was a solid wrestler, and he was able to wrestle his way to victories. Was it 9 times in a row? And I mean, I just showcased kind of, you know, my kryptonite was being put on my back. And so that was just kind of like the challenge, the like, let's just see if I can, you know, if we've grown enough to defeat such a person. And yeah, so finally fighting him, we our wrestling was better. And I felt confident in that. And then we were able to TKO him just because he wasn't able to get what he wanted to accomplish. So I think that fight was kind of like the pinnacle of like, now we game plan, now we can wrestle, now we're a complete mixed martial artist. And yeah, and so that was kind of like the eye opener of like, all right, we filled the holes and now we're ready to move forward.
I thought you, sometimes people get affected mentally by performances. He was legit. Loses to you, loses his next 4 fights, and that's it. I think you broke him. I think, again, I hate to say that if he's listening, but like, I thought that guy had a lot of upside, came in as the favorite, and then he couldn't get his hand raised after that.
I mean, recovering from a loss is an attribute in itself. And you see guys up on the highest level of a Cody Garbrandt or Tony Ferguson, right? Like, is suffering losses and recovering from losses is an ability in itself, and not a lot of people have it.
What's your process
on what happened with, what's my process of coming back from losses? I don't care about outcomes, man. My love of the sport is the 15 minutes I'm in there. And then the end result doesn't really matter, like affect me as much as it does everyone else. So, I'm in this for the challenge. I've been trying to challenge myself since I was 16 years old. Like, I'm trying to get beat up and beat up in front of millions, so that way I can grow as a better person. Fighting for me is the constant search of self-improvement. And you don't find that in perfection. You find that through failure. And losing a fight to me just gives me an example of the things I need to do differently and need to do better. And it gives me motivation to like what we can do next. And so I think for me, overcoming from losses, overcoming from failure is just the part of life.
You had 17, just under 20 fights prior to getting to the UFC, professional fights plus your amateur career. You've got guys coming into the UFC 4-5-0 that have never been physically punched in the face as a professional. How does that sit with you?
I mean, my occasional losses put it to where I couldn't get in the UFC as 4-0 or 5-0, but man, my experience and the mat time and cage time that I'm bringing into the UFC was something very different. And once I finally got there, I realized that I had tougher fights on the regional circuit than I did in the UFC. The regional circuit, the VFC, man, those cats were hungry. They were trying to prove themselves. And then they gave you 100%. Some fighters in the UFC, that's all they want to do is make it to the UFC. And they step off the gas a little bit. So, man, going into the UFC with the resume that I had gave me confidence that there's nothing they can do to me.
Yeah, Victor J, I got to agree with him on that. Like, your card, I mean, I'm from Chicago. You're like 9 hours driving away. And I remember, like, looking at your cards at the time, just how stacked they were. You really were doing something special at that time. Like, you really were. Not affiliated with a gym. You know, most promotions had a gym owner attached to them. You were truly one of the few independent people. Didn't manage anybody.
You know, going back to Omaha, it really made it easy. The talent pool was so deep at that time that it really made it easy. I mean, I think we had 22 guys go into the UFC from the VFC. And when you got, I mean, Drew probably had 10 of those guys in his gym alone. So it made it really easy. And the difficult part was trying to find opponents for that deep talent pool.
After Jordan Johnson, you get called the Ultimate Fighter. How did you know you made it?
I mean, No, I never had the feeling that I made it.
Through the interview process? Really?
What?
Through the Ultimate Fighter? I was a certain line?
It was outrageous. Let me tell you, it was outrageous. I mean, I left that interview going like, what? Like, the questions they were asking me were just the most outrageous things I've ever, I was just so dumbfounded. And they only gave you like 60 seconds of mitt time and jujitsu. I was like, what are they trying to find? Like, even if you're talented, they can't see that. And then the questions they asked you in the interviews were just so off the wall.
Can you give us an example?
So you got beat by Chase Hackett. You know he's gay, right? Like it was just threw you off. And it was just like a series of questions like that. And really what it was, I was talking to a good friend of mine, James Krause, who was also kind of like doing the same thing. And he says, because it's not what you say, it's how you say it. They're looking for reality stars, not fighters. And I went, oh, okay. So the callback gave me I was surprised. I was like, oh, you guys want to hear from me again? And then the second interview, we played it up. They're like, you looked fat in this picture. How much did you weigh? And I was like, I was fat in that picture. I was enjoying Vegas for the first time. You want me to take my shirt off? I look better now. And just they wanted that excitement. They wanted to make a show. And it was only after the second interview that I was like, okay, so we just got to be loud. That's it.
Wow. Dude, James Krause, absolute genius.
Yeah, brilliant.
Brilliant mind. Yeah. He's in an unfortunate situation right now. I mean,
yeah, I have my hesitance on kind of what he put himself in.
He's a brilliant guy.
But James Krause and I have like this weird friendly rivalry for our entire career because we thought we were going to fight each other eventually. So we were friends, but also kind of like, we're probably going to have to kill each other eventually.
Yeah. You know, he's in an unfortunate situation right now. And I'm not asking you to comment this, probably better that you don't, but the IRS is going to get him and it's going to be on taxes. It's not going to be on what it is they're accusing him of, which is a crime. Like, I don't know. Don't even get me started on the feds. Joe Exotic, 20 years in jail, a drugged up meth head. We got him. You know what I mean? Get the fuck out of here.
Ted Worthington. I would say, man, stay clear away from all that stuff. Pay your taxes. Yeah. You know, like just, yeah. I mean, I've ended up in jail despite the way I was living. So like, there's definitely a way to do it.
Yeah, it's crazy. Ted Worthington wins by submission. You win by submission, verbal submission. He's got a win over Darren Elkins. Has a lot of weight cutting issues, but a formidable Midwest opponent. Let's rewind a little bit. The Ultimate Fighter House, did you think you were going right into it, or did you know you had a fight to get into the house?
You knew nothing. That Ultimate Fighter, I mean, I can't speak for every season because I was just on that rare live season. And so they decided to do with like the live thing. It started off spending 7 days in the Palace Station. You couldn't leave your room. Like they confiscated your cell phone. They put you in a room. They said that even look outside your door, you're off the show. So I spent 7 days like shuffling cards and like reading a book in my room. And you get kind of like, you know, the prison rules of you get an hour to train with somebody. And I mean, it got to a point where we were just taking that hour just to have conversation with another person. Like it was a very extreme. And I they want to do that because they want to build that cabin fever. And then as soon as they opened the doors, they went, make weight because you're fighting that guy. Go. And it wasn't ideal for, the purpose. And for me, I was training so hard on being able to be the most athletic, most skillful fighter. And then when we got released from the hotel room, we only had one round and I pulled the college wrestler. And I thought to myself, all you have to do is get on top and he's going to win this thing, you know? So like, I was so stressed with that 24 hours of like, I need to be able to beat this college wrestler. Then found out while in the cage that he was actually a karate background. So it was just like, man, I felt like I was going back in the OFC days on a UFC level of like, I didn't know who I was fighting. I didn't know when I was fighting. I didn't know what I had to do. We only had one round to do it. And man, it was just a disaster. And I don't think the season came out well either. So for me, it was what we took away from that is I then knew that the UFC knew who I was.
How were you mentally? I mean, you lose to Cruikshank, you know, Darren Cruikshank, obviously formidable opponent.
I lost a round to Darren Cruikshank. Like, yeah. He was gassed out so hard after that 5 minutes. If it was a true fight, we would have made it in the house, but I only had one round. So props to Darren to making that 4 minutes look real good.
You draw Will Brooks, you know, after Ted Worthington, future Bellator champion. Will Brooks is a friggin' stud. You were literally trying to fight the toughest in the country.
Exactly. Yeah. We took that fight in a week's notice because we wanted to fight a really tough guy. And I mean, just the fact that he was the Bellator champion, he beat Michael Chandler twice. He's definitely a phenom. I think it was just, I bit off more than I can chew in a week's notice. And yeah, he beat me.
Robert Rojas, super friggin' tough. That guy is a friggin' savage. You win by rear naked choke. Sean Wilson, P-Town, 50 Fight Club member, I might add. You win by rear naked choke as well. Like, you're on a roll, but it seems like the last minute fights are what sets you back. Is that kind of computing in your head?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was the over enthusiasm, the you know, kind of like that Midwest mentality of like, I'm willing to fight anyone, anywhere, anytime. And unfortunately, if you want to make a career out of this, and I'm going to tell my future like prospects fighters that you got to make intelligent decisions. It's not always about grit and iron.
Since you're in fights, has Aaron Darrow, I think that Travis Quarter's a promoter. TJ O'Brien, super friggin' tough guy. TJ O'Brien is no joke. He was on Tough 12 or didn't get into it, but was right there.
Mm-hmm. That was the fight where I told myself, like, this was it. That was it. He was on the Ultimate Fighter. He fought in the UFC. He's a veteran. This was my time. And I went in with such like focus and enthusiasm that I was going to put him away and the UFC was going to give me a call. And I ended up submitting him. And I was like, this is it. Here we go. I'm ready. And we heard nothing. Yeah, it was just crickets after that.
Ryan Stoddard was your manager at this time, correct?
Yeah, give or take. I mean, he had the title, but not the responsibilities. I think that was the time where we were kind of getting the idea of, you know, he's not doing much. I need to do things on my own. So that after the TJ O'Brien fight was when I had a meeting with my coach and my mentor about, hey, I just beat the UFC veteran and I didn't get a call. Like, what do we need to do? What's happening? And we came up with the idea of I might not have the eyes, but I can find somebody that does have the eyes. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to their backyard, beat their ass and steal the limelight from them. And that's what we did against Tony Sims.
So Tony Sims, October 18, 2013, fight to win. You win a split decision.
Yes, that was probably one of my favorite fights, bar none. My toughest fight, my most favorite fight, and we got the job done. I mean, I was basically walking around JCPenney shopping mall. I got a call from Ryan. He's like, Seth Daniels wants you to fight Tony Sims. I don't like that fight. I'm going to tell him no. I said, absolutely not. We're taking that fight. He goes, have you seen this guy? He's winning by knockout in the first round every single time. The dude's a monster. And I said, yeah. And the UFC is looking at him. So if I want to be in the UFC, I got to be able to beat this guy. So I'm like, call back Seth Daniels, renegotiate the price, and we're going to get this done. And lo and behold, like, he was the toughest fighter I've ever fought. He knocked me down 3 times in that first round. Like, the guy was a monster. Dude. Granite in his hands. Hardest I've ever been hit. But, yeah, he's never been out of the first round. And what we learned with my amateur career is there's something to be said about being into that second, third round for the first time in your career. And I got off that stool going into the second round, knowing that I had it in my, like, my heart, my brain, like, we get it done. So we gave him war and he wasn't able to keep up. And he was doing his best to try to like find a way to win. He couldn't find it. And that's how we won his split decision.
Yeah. He, not only was he a savage, but like he, man, at this time, people are like, he's a pretty boy. He's a pretty boy. Drew Dober, when you got dropped three times, that was a 10-8 round. Like, that was a 10-8 round, and you had to decisively win the next two, and you didn't bend, you didn't fade, you just, it was like you became who you were supposed to be. Like, you finally kind of put everything together.
Right, right. I mean, he just showed that I'm just the real-life Rocky Balboa. That, you know, like, I can answer questions with my left hand and you can't put me away because of my chin. And I think it was just that shock and awe of, you know, I get to bring in that grit and iron in every single fight. And this is why people don't want to fight me anymore.
You got called to the UFC. How does that phone call go?
God, it was painful. I was sitting in a diner enjoying my birthday, eating a ridiculous amount of food. And I got that call, like, can you fight in 2 weeks in the UFC? And if the UFC calls, you just say yes. And, yeah, I got into that gym, and we literally were just had to start cutting weight. The fight was at 170, and I still had to cut weight to get to 170. We were fat. So we got we accepted, we took it, and we put forth our best effort despite basically coming off the couch.
Dude, isn't that crazy? Like, that's kind of the beginning of the only way you get to the UFC is by taking last minute fights. Like, the majority of the, like, the new signees tend to fall into that category.
Right.
What's your thoughts on that?
I love how the UFC does not even take in consideration that I just got done fighting Tony Sims. I mean, I got the call like days after that fight. Like, I still had stitches in my mouth. Like, and so I was like, hey, can you find 2 weeks despite the amount of concussions you've received in your last one? So, like I said, man, grit and iron. And that's what I showcase. And that is, we say yes and we get the job done no matter the who, when, and where.
Victor J, what are your thoughts about how, okay, you match made the independent scene. People always go like, oh, Sean Shelby, he's got such a hard job. Joe Silva, they got, you know, obviously no longer, had such a hard job. That's the easiest job in the world. No, everyone's afraid to say no to you. You're talking high-end guys willing to fight anybody, especially like knowing they're going to take a loss. Victor J, what, go ahead. I shouldn't have commented on my feelings, but the question's yours.
You know, I think it's still got to be difficult. I felt I had it easy because I was the middleman. You know, the goal is to get to the UFC. So guys would come knowing, like, as soon as guys started getting the call, all of a sudden my job became that much easier because eyes were on. I was, you know, talking to these matchmakers on a fairly regular basis. They'd hit me up and ask me about guys. And so I actually feel on that it was a little easier, but card changes are just part of the game. And I think when you get to the UFC level, I would think that guys are more worried about losing in the UFC than they are coming in and showing what they're capable of doing. And for me, I didn't really have that. I had guys that were hungry. They wanted to show the UFC what they had. They wanted to show everybody. So I really think I kind of had the easier job between the two.
Really?
I also think Victor J was probably one of the most professional matchmakers I've ever worked with. Yeah. So I it might not have been easy for him, but I think he just made it look easy.
Did you ever get stiffed? Did you ever get the promoter ever like promise you to pay and then stall from you?
Luckily enough, I didn't have that. But I mean, I worked with Victory J and Daniels. Yeah. Like I didn't surround myself with people that I had, bad vibes from. So intelligent matchmaking.
It's one of those boxes I like to check for veteran fighters. Like, you got to get ripped off like once. You know what I mean?
I mean, I got ripped off my amateur career fighting in strike first for no money. So like there was no expectations of pay, but yeah, we definitely didn't make any money there. So I think mine was just putting forth the best effort for zero money.
Yeah, why don't we make this come full circle before we end? August 25th, 2018, UFC Fight Night, Lincoln, Nebraska. You got John Tuck, Victory J. I think you were the inspector in the corner of this gentleman right here.
I was, you know, I was thinking when we spoke earlier, you're like, you know, one of the things, you know, about Drew over his career, my career, this actually was a highlight of my career. I had been out of the promoting game for 10 years at that point with the Nebraska Athletic Commission. And I was assigned to Drew's locker room, which was shared with James Krause and Justin Gangy. And Justin fought as an amateur for me as well. So being in there with these guys, it would just, it was a highlight for me, you know, seeing a guy that got his start with me. And now I'm the one that's sort of starstruck going, walking Drew out to the cage. I mean, it was awesome. It was like, really, out of everything, that is like a highlight for me to see things come around full circle. And I couldn't be more proud, you know, to see a guy who started fighting at 17 now on the biggest platform in the world and doing really, performing. Really well. So,
and performing.
I can't say enough, Drew. Yeah. I'm so proud of you, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. And now I remember that moment wholeheartedly. That was the moment where I was preparing for obviously a fight in the biggest stage in my career. And I get to be in the locker room with Victory J, Ryan Roberts, surrounded by the guys that I was also surrounded by when I first started. And it was just the moment where I realized that, man, like, this is like what I love doing. This is what I've always dreamed of doing. This is everything that that we've built together. And just in that locker room, I couldn't help but enter that fight with a smile on my face, because no matter what happens, like, we get to do this and we are doing this. And, you know, the fact that we get to do it together was absolutely incredible.
Yeah. You know, Drew, I hope you realize that for an administrative point, it's like an administrative like side, when guys like you make it and like we see you, we're like, it's a different level of appreciation on our end, because we saw you. We saw you, like, you put the work in. There are several times in this timeline that 95% of people would have said, yeah, dude, I gave it a shot. Didn't work out. You never quit.
Mm-hmm. And that is literally the story that I'm creating, is you can achieve greatness if you just admit to the fact that you just don't quit. Yeah, don't sidestep. Don't quit. Don't put your head down. Yeah. So just ignore problems and keep moving forward. And, you know, it will eventually find you.
Okay. Ignore problems. So Chris Lytle, one of my guys, always said, if you want to be a world champion, you got to go in there, get your fucking ass beat from pillar to post. Walk out of there and go, yeah, just one little minor adjustment. And I won that fight, where everybody's just like, you know, we can't understand what's going on in your head right now. And that's the only, like, you apply that to any other job outside of fighting, you know, you're getting shown the door, but in MMA, you become a world champion.
Right. Right. You know, I've said it, chasing greatness, perfection is boring. So through failure, we're creating our own stories, and it is literally the most entertaining thing. And that is the thing I've learned since I was 17 years old working with Victory J, is failure doesn't matter as much as people say it does. And we're all creating this beautiful story that we can tell and annoy our grandchildren with.
Yeah, absolutely. You celebrated Christmas in Germany one year with Nick Hein, an opponent of yours. Dude, you've been around, man. Like, you've been around. You don't let being born in a small town, like in an area of the world where most people on the left and right coast say it's a flyover city, you've really done a lot for yourself, man. And it's greatly, greatly appreciated, you know, on our end.
I appreciate it. And I think it was just the fact that I was born in a small town that we're bringing up kind of like just that Midwest Nebraska mentality, and we're showcasing it, you know? And so if I was born anywhere else, I don't think we could have handled it. But because I was born in Omaha, Nebraska, we were able to do big things.
Excellent. Drew, thank you so much. Victory J, I'm going to need you to stick around for a little bit. Man, Neil Magny owes you a favor. You got reeled in with this.
He owes me many favors, so we're just going to add that to the pile.
Excellent, Drew. Thanks so much, man. I appreciate it, buddy.
Thank you so much. And Victory, it was good seeing you, my friend.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm honored.
Yeah. Victory J. All right. So this guy right here, Joey Venti. Joey's a California guy, not really involved with the Midwest scene. Met through the podcast, never met each other in person. But we love tracking just historical moments on the independent grind and, you know, and putting them up for consumption. Victor J, from a distance, let's talk about you. Tap Out was the first clothing line, but you came out with Victory Athletics almost at the exact same time. Am I correct?
You're correct. It's actually kind of funny. My first pro fighter in the UFC wearing Victory was Tyrone Roberts, and he fought David Dodd. I think it was like UFC 20 maybe in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And Tap Out was there, and they were promoting the new UFC Sega Dreamcast game. And Tito was there signing autographs, and Charles came over. He saw that I was repping another gear, and he was the coolest dude. Brought me over, introduced me to Tito, gave me a signed all this memorabilia and all this cool stuff. And half the guys in the UFC were wearing Tap Out. I was like, man, there's no way I could go up against this. I had no idea until years later that was their like big moment. That was their make or break moment, was that show. They had investors at that show. And I didn't realize how close we really were, but we had parallel lives selling T-shirts out of the back of a van, going show to show with Big Papa Schnocky. And if he would announce and I would do shirts, and if I didn't sell enough shirts, we didn't have enough gas to make it home. So that really is how, we cut our teeth in this industry and got to meet all these fighters and really got knowledgeable about the sport ourselves.
Big Papa Schnocky. Man, dude, we brought him up. I've even clipped it out, some of the segments we have with him, and I've sent it to his kids. And that guy, man, missed, sorely missed.
Agreed wholeheartedly, man. I mean, I think about it all the time. It's just, really, we had, he was my brother, man. We traveled, and, we had plenty of times where we had to just stop at truck stops because, there wasn't a hotel around or we couldn't afford to go to the hotel. And, it's just, we've got so many memories and it's just crazy. I mean, just in the travels with BPS alone is enough stories for an entire lifetime.
So Big Papa Schnocky, larger than life personality and completely sober.
It's amazing. A lot of people, he's got to be on something. I'm like,
what's he using? What's he on?
Right.
I will take this. You don't have to comment if you don't want to. But when Big Papa Schnocky passed, Bruce Buffer became who he is today. But prior to that, he was just a normal ring announcer with a suit on.
I'd agree with that.
I think Bruce 100% lifted the personality of BPS and kind of incorporated it into what it is he's doing today.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. He was a showman. He wasn't just an announcer. He was a showman. And so much more than that is he carried the event. He made the events easy because he would carry the event when all hell was breaking loose behind the curtain. He was able to present the show, keep people entertained, and nobody knew for the better.
If people booed, he would kind of interrupt the audience. But here, think about this. Audience booing, hey, let me tell you, boom. He'd say something, and they would go from booing to clapping. He had the ability to grab an audience and change, the direction of their ship. And, sometimes big boats, because you're looking at 2,000-3,000 people, sometimes they need a little time to kind of turn around in the harbor to where Big Papa Schnocky didn't need that. He did it immediately.
I'd agree. Yeah, he had he captivated the audience 100%.
Yeah, died of diabetes. Anytime I know he was announcing a show in this podcast, I owe it to him to say his name. A true road warrior. So, Victor J, let's talk about, we should have done this in the beginning of the show. Let's talk about with what you have going on right now with Nitro Tickets.
Sure. So this was actually an issue that Schnocky and I had together. So back when I was doing shows, tickets were done the way a lot of events are still doing them now. I got a show, I'm going to hand fighters tickets, hey, go sell these. You get to keep 25% or whatever it may be, and come back on the day of weigh-ins and we'll tally everything up. And it just became such a nightmare. And it's amazing to me that it was such an antiquated program. And long story short, we had an event at Harris Casino at two UFC veterans who are big ticket sellers, but good friends, said, hey, I'll get you tomorrow. Well, something happened. I don't know, snowstorm, tornado, whatever it may be. Tomorrow came and I had $4,000 in unsold tickets to a normally sold out show. If I had just had those tickets 24 hours earlier, we would have sold them, but doors are open now. We're on TV. We're just trying to, like, you know, fill the seats so it doesn't look like a void. And I really sat down after that show and brainstormed and said, you know, there's got to be a better way to do it. That became Cage Ticks. We did Cage Ticks for from 2009 to 2016. And then, you know, Cage Ticks now links to Nitro Tickets, and Nitro Ticks was a rebranding to incorporate things beyond combat sports, beyond cage fighting. You know, we do boxing, we do we did the Abu Dhabi and Vegas, the World Championship, you know. So basically, if any promoter is out there that needs a better way to do fighter tracking, this is it. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a program that we're trying to incorporate something else. This was built from the ground up specifically for my needs as a promoter. And once it started taking off, that's when I stepped out of promoting. I started working for the state. And it helps us to this day that we're able to easily see for inventory, to for tracking for tax purposes. Hey, these fighters sold this amount. There's no more, you know, monkey business on weigh-ins. It's just streamlined it. And I run into promoters all the time that are like, man, I wish I would have just known about this before.
So we use it. I work for Ignite. I do color commentary for Ignite with Jeremy Bjornberg. And that guy sings your praises. Absolutely loves you, loves the product. One of your soldiers. Victory J, can you give us one of your favorite stories from the independent grind?
Man, there's a lot.
Brad Kohler, any yeah, Brad Kohler related stories?
you know, it's difficult. It's difficult because a lot of my stories is going to out a lot of people. And, you know, I actually had a book offer back in the day, because I was with a guy named Joe Wilk and a guy named Ethan Day, and they're both jujitsu black belts, both standout guys, fighters. And we went to, it was a tri-state event. And I just went up there again to kind of to watch over, you know, some new prospects, that sort of thing. And we were just talking shop the whole way. It was a 2-hour drive. I'm like, you should do a book. It's like, the problem is that if I do a book, I'm going to have to use names. You know, I can't say, you know, this, you know, arbitrary fighter or whoever. They're going to want to name names. And if that happens, I'd be on a hit list like you don't even know. But I don't know if there's too many. I mean, like I said, the story with Drew, that really was a highlight of my career. You know, seeing a guy that started with me, now, you know, I'm the guy that's like looking up to him in the cage. That to me, those things are really powerful.
Well, here, the tide changed. Like, when he was in the amateurs, he's looking up to you. I mean, you were a very, very, like, respected, well-respected promoter here in the Midwest. I mean, there was other promoters here in the Midwest, but there was no caveat with you. Everybody knew what they were getting and who you were and what they were getting from you. And that was a very rare thing back then. Like, do you remember Randy Greenman, one of my favorite promoters? Hell's Angels got him, you know, chopped him up into several pieces, the guy out of, you know, St. Louis. Mm. It was just, dude, you doing your thing, man. It was awesome. It was awesome to see it from afar. I've always admired your work.
I appreciate it. It's just, it's one of those things. There's a lifetime of stories there. You know, when I was single, I used to have to like cull my storytelling because it all sounded like bullshit, but you know, it's there. And I've been really blessed to work with the people that I have over the years, to just be in the circle with guys like yourself, with Big Papa Schnocky, with all these fighters coming up. You know, I've been truly blessed to have the career that I have, and I wouldn't change it for the world. You know, I hear all the time, you know, if you could go back and change anything, would you? No, because I like how everything turned out. It turned out great. Sure, there were some tough times, you know, we were living out of our van for a while and everything, but I think that just made the success that much sweeter.
You know what, though? Like, that kind of encapsulates who you were in Schnocky. No, we're willing to sleep in a van to go to an independent show a few hours from here. And if he doesn't sell enough t-shirts, we're fucked. We're going to be begging for money. Right. I've had to send Big Papa Schnocky money. I've had a Western Union him money so we can get home from somewhere. But I knew, like, when he called, it was serious. it wasn't like he was, yeah, dude, I just need like 20 bucks. It was just like, dude, I need like $32.75. That's what it costs to fill this tank. It can get me home. Please, that's all. I don't need another penny more. If you send it, I'll start walking now. My phone's about to die.
Right.
I'm like, yeah. Yeah, dude, go to Western Union. It'll be there.
Yeah, that is you know, when he passed, one of my final stories, and the publisher was great. Doug Jeffries was great in that he gave it twice as much. I think I had four pages dedicated to Big Papa Shnocky. And you know, the best quote I think that was in there where we were chasing our dreams through cornfields, and that really was it, you know, and it was such a great time. You know, I was so blessed for the time that I had with him. And you know, Mike, you knew him really well as well. And the thing that when he passed, you know, everybody was distraught about it. But I thought about this, and there are people who met him one night and it changed their lives. They'll talk about it. It's like, oh, you know, I got introduced to Big Papa Shnocky, and he was this great. This was one night. We got to spend years with this guy. And so I'm blessed in that these people were just happy for an hour and an introduction and just a conversation. And we got to be with this guy for as long as we did. We really were the ones that were blessed.
Yeah. You know, Victor J, like I work for Bare Knuckle Boxing, and going to these events, I can't tell you how many times I think, man, Shnocky'd be all over this shit.
Like he was born for it, man.
Yeah. It'd be like, this is where he belonged. You know, I mean, Shnocky had no business fighting, did one just to say he did it. You know what I mean? Like he was fucking awesome, man. Yeah.
Yeah. I got, so a grind day story. He was our announcer. We had what we referred to as the idiot shows. And these were weekly events. This was before the VFC. These were weekly events where you would just show up and you would sign a waiver and you'd fight. It was at a bar on a Wednesday night, and it was boxing, MMA, it was NHB at the time, no holds bar, and submission wrestling. And it didn't matter if a guy had drinks or not. It didn't really, you know, you look buckle. At the guy, hey, how much do you weigh? 180? Oh, you weigh 180? Okay, cool. There was no scale. It was just,
yeah.
And Shnocky would be on the microphone trying to get people to go, you know, hey, who's up? This guy's looking for a fight. And one guy in particular came in, and they kind of got into it a little bit on the microphone. He said, well, why don't you put your money where your mouth is and get in here and fight? So he said, 2 weeks, I'll be back to fight, or something to that extent. And sure enough, and the guy's name was Tim Baser, who was the promoter of the Omaha Fight Club, shows up, and he spent 2 weeks training while Shnocky spent 2 weeks at Burger King, and they got in there and fought. They fought. This was one of his Shnocky's unrecorded fights, and it went the distance. He ended up losing. I think it was a decision, but he was so beat up from it. He was on the oxygen tank. He was like, you know, and he had to go do multiple events. And I think he actually did there was an IFC where it was a welterweight tournament, and it was a who's who. I mean, Chael Sonnen was there, Jeremy Horn and Baba Lou were in the finals, and he was the on camera guy, all beat up still. You know, he still had a shiner and that sort of thing.
He had Jens Pulver himself. There was one other person in that booth.
That was a who's who cast as well.
Yeah.
But you know, he just stepped in and he didn't train. He was just like, I'll get in there and fight. And it was amazing. You know, I know we kind of like poke fun throughout this podcast about the Wild West days of Omaha Fight Club. They are still around, and a lot. I mean, MMA would not be where it is today if it wasn't for events like the Omaha Fight Club. If it wasn't for places where a guy could step in off the street and get his first fight, see if it's what he wants to do or not. And they're still doing it. They're still going strong. And I mean, it's been 20 something years, and a lot of events you really can't say that about.
So Joey is a California native. Joey, was it the Cobra Fighting Federation?
Oh yeah. Mark Hall.
So Mark Hall's event was kind of like that as well.
Oh, it was absolute Wild West. People
coming out of the stands to fight, letting drunk people fight, letting they had a 300-pound lady fight a drunk guy once. It was insane.
Sean Strickland was recently on Joe Rogan. I think I counted three times he called Mark Hall a piece of shit. His words, not mine, nothing to do with it. Also, it's, you know, like Gabby Garcia, the best way he can like say about, yeah, rolling with her was like rolling with a fat chick. You know what I mean? It was, you know, still a woman. I'm like, oh, you know, he might be Don Fry's kid. That's my guess on Sean Strickland. But Victor J, we're going to wrap this up. I'm going to tell you, Victor J, in all honesty, next time BKFC is back in Omaha, I promise you, I'm going to stop by. We're going to have some lunch,
man. Yeah, let's do it, man. I'll be there. I'll be there. For any of your audience that has not tuned into the BKFC, that is, you know, when I went to the first one, I wasn't really sure what to expect. You know,
wait, you went to the first one in Wyoming or which one?
No, the first time that I got to see a live one here in Nebraska. And I was thinking, you know, it felt barbaric. And even after being in the sport for so long and sitting in on panel discussions with neurologists that have said it's safer than MMA when it comes to CTE and that sort of thing, I will tell you, it changed me. I felt like I was watching the old golden years of MMA. Ladies and gentlemen,
you need, in order to understand what NHB the era was, you need go travel, take some vacation days. You need to see BKFC now. Because if you do it a few years from now, it's going to be much different than what it is now. You need to see it now. Like, this is one of those rare opportunities where you can kind of hit that rewind button and see what it was all about. Victor J, I cannot agree more with you.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Mike, thank you for allowing me the time, man. Anytime I can talk shop, it's great to go back memory lane, and this has just been, it's been such an honor, man. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Victor J, Joey, please attest to this. Usually there's twists and turns in the road. Drew Dober is like a decent human being, like to the core. There was nothing there. Joey, please.
Look, I can't say I woke up this morning a fan of Drew Dober, but like, how can he not love that kid? I'm rooting for him now, you know. He seems like such a positive influence. I see online he either is just about to be a dad or he just became a dad. And, I'm sure he's great at that. I'm a huge fan of his now.
Yeah, I mean, we've had Drew Fickett on, Dennis Hallman, Horwich. Even like Chael Sonnen was talking about, yeah, Dan Severn stole from me. Like, we've got so much gold. I knew we were going to come into a good interview with Drew, but I knew there was not going to be one of those – holy shit, I can't believe he just said that. So we're going to have you on again. Maybe one of the Ellenbergers or Jason Brills, one of those guys. But all those Omaha boys are all clean living. Like, that's, you know, kind of sad for us. So, Joey.
Pleasure being here. I'm glad I got to sit on this interview. Drew Dober, I usually don't like fighters that are that good looking, but I'm a fan now. So thanks for letting me sit in on this one.
Victor J, thanks, buddy. We'll be in touch, man.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Check out the full interview on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms.